This is 89.9 WWNO. I'm Janae Pierre, and it's time for All Things New Orleans. On today's show, we'll discuss a social experiment that confronts the racial wealth gap. Then Jessica Rosegard returns with Cityscapes columnist Richard Campanella. And later, we'll chat about Hike the Lafitte Greenway, a free community event happening this weekend. That's all coming up on All Things New Orleans. Stay with us.
Good morning, evening, friend.
A recent pop-up at Rue Carré used food to confront customers about the racial wealth gap in America. How? Well, Nigerian chef Tunde Wey decided to sell his single dish to minorities for $12 and suggested white customers purchase the same dish for $30. Chef Tunde Wey and Angelique Prazertung join me now to talk more about this social experiment. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Tunde, I know you spent time cooking in Detroit before landing here in New Orleans. Just briefly share your background and tell us what led to this project.
So I'm Nigerian. I moved from Nigeria about 18 years ago. I opened up a restaurant in Detroit in about 2013, and we were serving American food, and my partner and I just had different chefs come into our restaurant and cook and serve their food. So after a year doing that, I felt a little restricted. I wanted to do more with the food that we were serving, and I felt like Nigerian food was the perfect platform to stretch the format of restaurants and how people thought about food. So I wanted to open up a Nigerian restaurant. I couldn't find a chef who would help me do that. And since it was the food that I grew up eating and I knew the food well, I was like, I'll just do it myself. And I started cooking. It was terrible at first. So that's what happened. Then I left Detroit. I traveled a bit cooking. And then I had a chance to come to New Orleans to open up at the Saint Roch Market. I did that. And then I just continued. And then in 2016, like, my food and my cooking sort of like took a turn and became more explicitly political. And instead of critiquing food culture with my food, I decided to be less frivolous and critique the larger sort of construct that govern food and society, and use food as a platform for that. So I started hosting dinners around race, around gentrification, development, immigration, and now the racial wealth disparity.
So let's jump right into it. What's the point of charging white people more than twice the amount for your dish?
To be clear and specific, white folks were given an option. So it was a suggested price. So they could either pay the regular price, which was $12, or they could pay the $30, which was 2.5 times more, which reflects the wage disparity in New Orleans. So in New Orleans, the median net income for white folks is just about $64,000. For black families, it's $25,000. So we were sort of showing in practice what that looked like, or what the burden of costs looked like for folks of color in the city.
I'm curious to know the response you received from customers, because as you mentioned, it was a suggested price. Mm-hmm. But what response did you receive from people? Were white people upset about it? Did they understand? Did black people feel like they were getting a discount for some reason? What was the response?
The thing that I saw with folks of color, black folks, was they were surprised, and most of them like were amused by the project.
Were they surprised because of the wealth gap?
Everybody was surprised because of the wealth gap, but they were surprised in the pricing disparity. Mm-hmm. And I think folks were also surprised at, like, maybe the boldness of the project, like asking white folks to pay a price higher. So that was black folks. The white folks, I think, were also surprised, but there was like a range of expression of this surprise, and sometimes the surprise like ended differently. For some folks, it turned into like genuine excitement and interest mm-hmm. in the project. For some other folks, it was an inconvenience that I think they were trying to circumvent. They maybe agreed in principle, but not in practice. And for some other folks, it was like being waylaid, and they didn't know what to do, and So there were a range of responses from folks.
So, Anjali, you were mentioned in an article, and I want to bring you in on the conversation. In fact, you're a grad student at Tulane volunteering to collect data on customer behavior. Let's talk about some of your findings from those surveys.
Sure. Well, we had 78% of white people that came to the stall did end up paying the $30, which was honestly kind of a surprise for Tunde and I, because, you know, we did expect that people would pay, but maybe not in quite those high numbers. Mm-hmm. And another aspect of the experiment is that the extra money that was collected, we told people that it was going to be redistributed to people of color who came to the stall. So as part of our data collection, we also asked minority customers if they wanted to receive money back. And about 81% of them said no. That was also maybe a higher proportion than we expected. And we also did interviews with people just to get a little bit more in depth in their decision to either pay the higher price or not, or if they were minorities to take money back or not. So we just solicited information about why they made their decision and also the ways that they were able to have access to resources or not as they were growing up.
Tunde, hearing those findings, and I'm sure you had your eyes on the data as well, how does that make you feel?
What was interesting to me is that the folks who chose to pay the $30, the 78%, the other 22%, if my math is correct, there was some recognition that the 30 was the more acceptable choice to make, but for some reason they weren't able to pay the 30. So there was a lot of equivocation. You know, folks wanted, I mean, there was actually sometimes a negotiation like, well, can I pay $18, something between the 12 and the 30? So I think the point is, maybe anecdotally, everybody wanted to pay the 30 because I don't know, we had created this, again, this sort of framework that lent itself to folks paying that extra money. The conclusion that I draw from the numbers, at least on the white side of things, is that there's a recognition of what the problem is. And I think folks are partial to contributing to a solution. And we can help folks along in contributing towards that solution by creating circumstances that make it more socially acceptable. I think the more we begin to codify what is acceptable and what is not, especially in areas like this, then I think the better success we have at closing the wealth disparity. I mean, that's my opinion. I don't know if...
Yeah, I think it also has something to do with just having a conversation with Tunde, and he's a very sympathetic person, you know, a very likable person. And it's hard to have a conversation with someone who is giving you these numbers and then turn around and say no and reject them. And it's just a difficult choice to make.
Yeah. Now, this social experiment is over at Rue Carree. And I know earlier you mentioned that you did dinners surrounding conversations about race. But with that said, what's next for you?
My next project is going to be in Detroit. We're using food and restaurant space to critique discriminatory development. So any sort of development that is more focused on driving property values and displacing folks as opposed to creating community. And so you talking about how restaurant spaces and farms in communities of color have become weaponized in the displacement of folks in those communities.
Mm-hmm. That was Tunde Wei and Anjali Prazer-Tung. Thanks for joining me today.
Thanks, Janae. Thank you.
Tunde Wei will be presenting the data and findings of his project on March 15th at Propeller. For more information, visit gopropeller.org/events. You're listening to All Things New Orleans. I'm Janae Pierre. Most listeners probably didn't know that back in the 1800s, there was a canal that ran through Central City. I sure didn't. WWNO's Jessica Rosegard sat down with Richard Campanella, geographer with the Tulane School of Architecture and columnist for NOLA.com, The Times-Picayune, to talk about how the Gormley Canal shaped New Orleans.
We are talking today about the Gormley Canal, which, as you write, was completed in 1828, and it was a resource extraction canal. Explain to me what that means and what makes it different from some of the other canals.
Yeah, well, there were a number of motivations for New Orleanians to excavate canals historically. One was navigation. Another was for drainage. In some cases, they were for energy. These would be river diversion canals. When the river was high, they would open it up. Water would flow down, in one case, right on Elysian Fields Avenue and power a sawmill. Another one, it was for the extraction of natural resources and their delivery into the city. These generally, unlike navigation canals, which of course would connect to an open water body like Lake Pontchartrain, resource extraction canals usually terminated in the back swamp, and that's where the resources were. Cypress logs, fill, very importantly, clay, and that could be used to make bricks. So the Gormley Canal is one of the biggest, best examples of a resource extraction canal within the urbanized footprint on the East Bank.
When the Gormley Canal was finished, it wasn't in New Orleans, so tell us where it was.
It was in Jefferson Parish, which was designated in 1825, and that was everything above Felicity Street. As of 1833, that area immediately above Felicity Street was a separate city known as Lafayette. So the location of the canal was about 1 mile long. The turning basin, which was known as Gormley's Basin, was on the what is now the 1800 block of Aretha Castle Haley Boulevard. At the time, it was known as the Dryad's Walk or Dryad Street. And today, if you could just imagine where St. Andrew Street jogs across O.C. Haley, there's a mortuary there and like an open field, and Dryads makes a little bit of a curve there. That would have been the quay. There would have been two quays, meaning docks or piers. The fact that the canal basin had quays tells us that it wasn't a drainage canal, because those docks and piers would have blocked the flow of runoff. It extended right down what is now St. Andrew Street, which would have been the dividing line between the old Ursuline nuns parcel and the Panis plantation. So William Gormley, who had this canal excavated, he basically was able to privatize that space between, and it would have run to just lakeside of South Claiborne Avenue, 1 mile back, and that would have been dense back swamp at the time. So this canal brought in these resources to essentially build Central City. Timber came out of there, brick came out of there, and like a lot of these back swamp canals, they formed these little inland light industry hotspots. So there were soap makers, there were lumber mills, firewood businesses all around the Gormley Canal. In many cases, Irish and German immigrants worked these canals and they settled nearby. And so here you have a project like this end up influencing immigrant settlement patterns.
In 1852, you report New Orleans annexed the city of Lafayette, which meant acquiring the Gormley Canal. What impact did that have?
Well, there was actually some talk at that time of connecting the New Basin Canal with the Gormley Canal, and both would have accessed the lake. That would have been extraordinary. That would have meant there'd be a wide channel coming down today's South Rampart or O.C. Haley. It never happened, but if it did, we'd have a very different central city today. So what did happen was the terrible yellow fever epidemic of 1853. And a lot of medical researchers pointed their fingers at the Gormley Basin and the Gormley Canal as a culprit. But there was some varying data here. There were some residents right next to the basin who suffered black vomit and died. And so some researchers pointed to that as evidence that there's a connection here. But others pointed to other parts of the canal where there were no yellow fever deaths. So in other words, the different hypotheses of these medical researchers trying to solve the yellow fever mystery, each of them found some level of evidence in the Gormley Canal. But there was a general consensus that, first of all, the thing was absolutely filthy. Carcasses of dead horses and cattle were thrown in the basin. One description describes as the sun would beat down on the fetid waters, this kind of greenish black foam. So neighbors really hated it, and that's what led to its eventual filling in. The basin was filled in the right after the 1853 epidemic. The rest of the canal was open during the time of the Civil War and filled in incrementally. By the late 1860s, the maps I've inspected, it is completely erased. And by maps such as the Robinson map of 1883, urbanization has filled in so well that you could never have tell that there was a 40-year-old canal there. But there are some clues.
And tell me, Richard, what are those clues? What's left of the Gormley Canal?
The cityscape reveals the past in mysterious ways. What you have to look for are these little slight quirks and jogs in the streetscape. Next time you're on O.C. Haley, if you go to the Rue Carré eatery there, the little food court there, notice how St. Andrew on the riverside makes an odd jog across O.C. Haley and continues about 100 feet a little bit downriver before heading toward the lake. That 100 feet, well, the canal was 80 feet wide, 10 feet for a footpath on one side, 10 feet for a towpath on the other. That's 100 feet. Now continue on St. Andrew toward Claiborne, and around what used to be LaSalle Street, St. Andrew makes another jog. And if you look at one side of St. Andrew to the other, it's exactly 100 feet. So it's in little peculiarities in the cityscape that we could tease out that there was something different happening there.
So as many of us are driving in and around New Orleans, when streets do odd things, we should consider that there's a historic reason for it.
Many times they're all plantation lines. Sometimes they're all waterways. I like to tell my students, things at odd angles tell interesting stories.
Richard Campanella, thank you so much.
You're welcome, and thank you.
Hey, still with us? You're listening to All Things New Orleans. I'm Janae Pierre. Friends of the Lafitte Greenway will present a free community celebration this weekend, including live music, historical guided tours, and more. Joining me now to talk about Hike the Lafitte Greenway is Executive Director Sophie Vorhoff. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, Friends of the Lafitte Greenway was formed in 2006. Take a minute and tell us about the vision this group of community members shared in regards to the city's landscape.
Absolutely. The stretch of land that we're talking about was right in the heart of the city in some of our most historic neighborhoods and some of our most culturally rich neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. There's a strip of land running about 3 miles long that was vacant, overgrown, former rail corridor that really just divided communities from each other. And folks that lived in these neighborhoods, Treme, Mid-City, around 2006, saw an opportunity after the storm to really rethink what their neighborhood looked like, to transform this vacant space into an amenity that would contribute to the quality of life, that would bring folks together, that would encourage people to be active. And they started really organizing around this vision and sharing this vision with their neighbors by walking the Greenway, hiking it. It was truly sort of bushwhacking at that time. talking with public officials who soon really embraced the vision. And it's thanks to sort of this partnership between community members and city leadership that we have the Greenway that we have today.
Before we jump into the details of this annual event that you guys are having, let's get a quick history lesson. Many people know the Lafitte Greenway as a convenient path to go from Mid-City to the French Quarter or vice versa, but take us back to the late 1700s.
Well, the history of the space of the Lafitte Greenway is deeply tied to the history of New Orleans itself. So the reason that New Orleans, the French Quarter, was founded where it was on the banks of the Mississippi is because of the proximity to Bayou St. John. And, you know, the mouth of the Mississippi, the Delta is very challenging to navigate, but you can go from the Mississippi River, portage across land. The portage route was Bayou Road, mm-hmm. and then go up Bayou St. John into Lake Pontchartrain, Lake Bourne, and out to the Gulf. So this is really important for trade. And for the economy of New Orleans, mm-hmm. it's still a pretty long portage to go from the river's edge to Bayou St. John. And so when in 1794, the governor at the time, the Spanish governor, commissioned the development of a canal, which would aid transportation, but also drainage of the city. Okay. And so that canal is the Carondelet Canal, and that's the sort of original footprint of what is now the Lafitte Greenway.
History facts like the one you just shared are just one of the features that folks can expect at Hike the Lafitte Greenway this weekend. What else can folks expect?
We have a really special event planned in honor of the tricentennial. And so we're going to focus a lot on the history of this space as a canal, as a railroad. We've partnered with the Historic New Orleans Collection to print signage showing historic images of this site, which will be really fabulous. So you can look out at a trail and a bike path and walking path, but also see a canal in this space, right? Yeah. Really harken back through time. We're also going to be celebrating the culture of the neighborhoods along the Greenway and the cultural history. And so we'll have free guided tours. It's a 3-mile walking tour of the Greenway. Along the route, there will be music. We are featuring Darien the Hip Drops, the Secondhand Street Band, Slick Leo, and the Red Flame Hunters, which are the only all-youth Mardi Gras Indian tribe.
Wow.
So we are very, very excited about the musical lineup this year.
That's great. And, you know, one of my favorite things to attend is a block party, and there's one happening at the end of this event, correct?
That's right. We'll walk right down the Greenway and end at Second Line Brewing, where there will be food trucks, music, and about 20 organizations that will have activities and fun things for you to do. So it's family friendly. It's going to be a blast. And at the end, we provide free transportation back to the beginning. Since you just walked 3 miles, we'll get you all the way back.
Now, Sophie, you mentioned the city is turning 300 years old this year. With that said, though, how important is the Lafitte Greenway to the future of the city?
The city and community members have really created a public space, an amenity that allows us to really live fully and energetically in our bodies, right? To use our feet and our bicycles to get around in our communities. It's a place where you can really connect with neighbors, where you can, you know, interact with folks that you don't always get to see that are from different neighborhoods. The Greenway connects 6 different neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. And also really connecting to our environment. There's a tremendous amount of green infrastructure, stormwater management features built into the Greenway, which is the way that we really should be managing our stormwater, mm-hmm. with trees, with bioswales, with plants. And so it's really creating a space that's, we hope, will keep shaping what our reality is, what our lives are like, in a way that's healthier and happier and brings us together.
That was Sophie Harris-Vorhoff, Executive Director of Friends of the Lafitte Greenway. Thanks for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
Hike the Lafitte Greenway is happening Saturday, March 10th at 9:30 a.m. For an event schedule and more information, visit lafittegreenway.org. And that's it for this week's edition of All Things New Orleans. I'm Janae Pierre. Would you like to suggest a guest or topic? Send an email to janae@wwno.org. That's janae at wwno.org. Visit our website to check out previous shows and be sure to catch us next week right here on 89.9 WWNO New Orleans and 90.5 KTLN Thibodaux Houma. Thanks for joining us. Public radio is an essential asset to any community, and WWNO is your source for great content from all over the world. But this is only possible with the financial support of you, the listeners. Give during our Spring Member Fest today by going online to wwno.org/donate or call 800-286-7002. That's 800-286-7002. And thank you.